Welcome to the Where Does It Come From podcast. I'm Jo Salter, your podcast host and founder of Where Does It Come From, a social enterprise focusing on kind clothes that tell tales. In this podcast, I chat with amazing people who've dedicated themselves to making our world a better place through business, social enterprise, campaigning, and much more. In this episode, I'm talking with Vanessa Barker, pioneer of regenerative agriculture in textiles and ethical fashion production. Listen to Vanessa's story, which started with making clothes for her children on her kitchen table and now involves managing huge projects to supply ethical products to business clients. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Where Does It Come From podcast. I have as my guest today the wonderful Vanessa Barker, who's been doing amazing work in the whole area of regenerative textiles. It's great to have you here. Welcome, Vanessa.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
First of all, I want you to introduce yourself, tell everyone who you are and what you've been up to. I'm sure they'd love to hear about your journey.
Well, it's been a long journey. I'm a little bit longer in the tooth than I was, and fair amount of negative knowledge, as we might say, along the way, but it's all learning. So yeah, my name is Vanessa Barker. I'm CEO and founder of Papillon Bleu, the blue butterfly. Our company was founded back in 2006, and in its original form was actually a B2C brand which created après beach products, which were 100% natural. And our value and pillars at that point were absolutely 100% natural fibers, revival of ancient craft techniques. So really using some of those beautiful old embroidery skills and the block printing and making sure that we make sure that these crafts stay alive. And then the third value was that fair trade, that we would always know and meet the owners of the factories that we worked with, spend time working with the embroideries, and understand, you know, that was a fair payment structure in place. So I guess really things haven't changed much from that original value set where we are today, but we are now a B2B brand and we have embraced many more sustainable practices, sustainable best practices. And with the knowledge that we have really, we also embarked upon our own journey in regenerative agriculture and textiles. And we have a partnership with Radis Cotton and an NGO called the GVK Society. I believe you've had Anil on your podcast before.
Okay. Yeah.
And yes, the best partners I could possibly ask for. We have a wonderful, traceable, rain-fed, regenerative cotton program running in southern India, via which we can make the most beautiful textiles and in a fully traceable supply chain where we totally know what farmers are being paid. We work directly with the tribal farmers and in a system that we know is regenerating land, you know, by sequestering the carbon, by restoring the soil, and also by using rain-fed only. We plant once a year in the monsoon season. So we're really working with nature and avoiding any of those water shortages that associated with conventional cotton growing. So not only that, but as you may or may not know, within the regenerative system, we embrace certain farming principles such as multi-cropping. So not only will you see a beautiful field of cotton, regenerative organic cotton in conversion, but you'll also see lots of other beautiful food plants growing alongside, you know, from aubergines to chili to chia seeds to rice to marigolds. So it's this beautiful food and fiber garden, all existing symbiotically aside, you know, alongside each other, which of course has a natural effect on the ecosystem. It rebuilds the fertility in the soil, and by which you're restoring biodiversity above and below ground. Because once you also remove the chemicals as well from the farming, herbicides and the pesticides, you know, everything starts to come back to life. But the other point about the food, which is so wonderful, is that that food product is going back to the tribal families. So they are getting this wonderfully nutritious, value out of that food garden. And then obviously being paid, well, not obviously, but in our case, are being paid above premium for that regenerative organic cotton that we at the end of the, is harvested.
Amazing, amazing. I mean,
There are so many other advantages, but we'll come to about the social side that we really have on the impact for, the tribal farmers.
it's really interesting hearing how passionately you talk about all the regenerative cotton and the farming and the tribal. I mean, because you and I are both, it's an area that's taken us both over. And anybody who hasn't listened to Anil Kumar and Ambavaram's podcast episode last year, please do, because he's right on the ground. He can tell you exactly how it is. And Vanessa and I are big fans of him, absolutely. I want to say hats off, not that we're wearing hats, to you for 2006. I mean, you are definitely a pioneer here. You are an early adopter, whatever you want to call it. I mean, you've been doing this for much longer than some of the people listening to this may not have even been born when you were already starting to work on this. It's a terrifying thought, but it shows you all the knowledge and the experience that you have gained and you are sharing. It's a fantastic, and I have to acknowledge that for sure. The other thing I also noticed was you didn't really talk about yourself very much in that introduction. You jumped straight into the cotton. So tell us about you. Are you a designer? What's your background? How did you get into this?
My entry into apparel and clothing was actually via me learning to pattern, cut, and sew, and getting completely obsessed and making all of my own children's clothes, including any sort of made-to-order fancy dress that they fancied at the time. And I just got completely and utterly obsessed because I think anyone who sews and the process of that is incredibly meditative. And it's a shame, perhaps, that more people don't sew, because you do get a better value of actually what it takes to make a piece of clothing, what's involved. And it gives you a closer connection to the thing that you've made. It has more value merely by the fact you've made it. So yes, that was really how I kind of went into the brand with Papillon Bleu. Some people had seen what I'd been doing, and then we embarked upon creating this beachwear brand, which was fantastic for a couple of years. We sold 180 boutiques worldwide, Saks Fifth Avenue, and we had a distributor in Paris. And then that crisis, that 2008 crisis of the US hit, and we got very badly hit by it. Carried along for a few more years creating the collections, but with order values down in 2012, that's when I switched to B2B. So we offer all of knowledge and the understanding how to build a sustainable product end to end, and the knowledge in terms of supply chains of how to do that. And dare I use that word, at a commercial price point.
And that's a key one. I mean, talking about the economic side, that is absolutely key, isn't it? It has to work commercially, and that's often a challenge that we face, when you are trying to run a successful brand. There's an expectation about prices, but not an expectation of the value that's going in across the supply chain. So you've done it and been there many times, I know, and talked about investment, talked with investors, and you've had other brands as well. And I've said to you before, it's like we're stuck in the middle sometimes between the people that we are collaboratively working with, who are the people across the value chain, all the way from farmers, spinners, weavers, garment makers, dyers, printers, whatever. And then the people on the other side, when it's talking to customers in terms of price expectation, both B2B and B2C, where they're expecting to have something at a very low price because that's what our economic model is telling them is right.
Well, I think the interesting thing there is the word value chain. And I think the old model, shall we call it that, is very much based on almost an extractive system by which the brand and the buyer is here, and right down the supply chain, there's somebody at the very bottom is going to be the most squeezed by that, and usually in a far off country, wherever that far off country is, because we can disconnect and we think it's okay. However, moving on from that, when I think about value chains, certainly in the cotton side of things, and I think it's really important to bring this up because there are many solutions that people have for sustainable fabrics, and we've got the GOTS organic certified fabrics. One of the issues that I have about cotton systems that aren't transparent and traceable is about that value ending up in the farmer's pocket. So you may, you know, the brand may pay a premium price for the organic cotton, but that by no means means that that money is ending up in the farmer's pocket. And that is where I have an issue, where supply chains aren't traceable, or where the money that's ending up in the farmer's pocket is not disclosed. That, to me, creates another area for, yeah, for abuse, really, should somebody want to abuse that system. So unless you actually know and can say, you know, these are the metrics, this is how much they get paid more, and this is how much, you know, per family their income increased last year, then really it's very opaque.
And it's the control element as well, isn't it? So who controls that? If we're still controlling where that money goes, as opposed to that money being passed over, or the ownership and the autonomy being with the people who are creating the value, then that's back to unfair, you know, post-colonial systems, whatever you want to say, extractive systems, where we're still refusing to let go of that control to be with the people creating the value, which never feels quite right to me. And it is an element of trust, isn't it? Which is not, again, not the economic model that we're used to, which is a difficult one, a very difficult one.
But doing anything like we used to is not really going to get us anywhere different than where we are.
No, I hate the expression.
So
Well,
we do have to think,
for
why do
years,
we do this?
yeah, for
You
years.
know, do some radical rethinking of the systems and how they are, and that is how we will create change
Exactly.
and, yeah, a more positive impact. And it
Exactly.
isn't, you know, it is actually quite simple when you put it in those terms. And when you were saying about how long, you know, since 2006, oh, you've been doing this, or you're a pioneer, I genuinely see it as quite logical. It's like, what, given the choice of a sort of synthetic petrochemical derived fiber that is going to take how many hundred years to biodegrade, and if I wear it, I will sweat in it, and versus a beautiful natural fiber that, you know, if I know it can be created in a fully traceable supply chain, which, you know, really enlivens the quality of the life of the people that are touching that cotton and contribute. I mean, why? It's logical. It's not even sustainable. It's, to me, logical. Or wouldn't you want to be a part of that system? And that's what we really want to get over on the consumer end as well, and the buyers in brands. But it's like, wouldn't you want to be a part of this world?
This is the world. This is the old world. This is the best world. I'm a bit
This
biased,
is
but
where you know the impact it had. This is where you can feel good, not just because the fabric feels good, but because you know it's doing good in the entire supply chain. And talking about feeling good, I just want to also talk about textile processing, because that's another interesting thing, that talking about doing things the way we've always done them. So this, for example, is our beautiful rain-fed regenerative waffle fabric, which I love, and we've been making robes. These are being supplied to 5-star hotels. And the point that I wanted to make about this is the natural color cotton as it is, you know, grown from the ground and made into a fabric. So zero herbicides, zero pesticides, all of the wonderful social impact that we talk about. But the interesting thing is then what happens next? And what a lot of times happens in textile processing is all additional processes that aren't necessarily ne necessary. So we might dye it white as a PFD
Oh,
in
yeah.
order to get another color on top. And is that necessary? So it's just always looking at what is the best, you know, impact model that we can create. So if we create whites, we will only use GOTS low impact white, not a corrosive bleach. And we also offer a ver array of different colouring processes, from the GOTS low impact colours, where you use your Pantone and it's just a better impact system, to also natural dyeing. And we've also been experimenting with industrial tea waste from the iced tea drinks in Sri Lanka, and
Really?
like 54 shades, everything from pinks to purples to greens. Incredible. But again, we can do this at an industrial scale that meets industry standards, and that is at a decent, a price point that's efficient. So it's about how do we do all of these great things? So we've got these fabrics, but what else is there out there that we can create these exciting, different models?
Amazing. For anybody who's just listening, you'll have to go over to the YouTube channel to see what Vanessa was holding up, but I'm sure she could also, it's on the Papillon Bleu website, so you can go and have a look at some of the beautiful fabrics that she's been working with on there. I agree with you so totally about the dyeing and the white thing. And I also have a view that this is something that's put on people. I don't think the end customers want everything to be this bright, like teeth, isn't it? Do we really have to have luminous white teeth? We don't have to have luminous white t-shirts either. But I did some work back with some African producers a few years back, and the prints that we bought assumed you had this white background, and of course we printed it on the natural cotton, and they looked absolutely amazing because the colors always had, they had a slightly cream background, and everyone loves them. So I think it's just something that is put on, this expectation that customers want everything to be white and bright and layery. But if
Yeah.
they knew what those dyes were doing, which they obviously don't, and natural colors are beautiful colors. Brings me to our Sanger Jeans project. So a couple of podcasts ago, there was an episode on our Sanger Stories organization, which is a collaborative brand set up through the ecosystem incubator. And you showing off your beautifully colored toweling robe thing showed that that's exactly the color that our Sanger Stories jeans will come in. And if anyone wants to go to the website, please do. And we're going to be running natural dye workshops in partnership with an organization we work with in India. And just people can choose and work with the dyes that they want their jeans to actually be in. And I think it's exactly what you said. There'll be nothing added apart from those dyes, and there'll be madder, and there'll be indigo, and there'll be other just amazingly beautiful shades that you can create from that. So yeah, I'm right behind everything you say. I also wanted to go back to the point you were making about premiums and autonomy and value creation, because again, something another chat we had was around how that's impacted in other models. And for me, I'm a fair trade campaigner as well. And one thing that's upset me over the last few years, I don't know if the audience realizes, is the pullback from the fair trade mark and the fair trade organization by big brands like Sainsbury's, for example, because with the fair trade model, a part of the price is put into the fair trade premium, which is then something that the people who are creating the goods, growing the tea or whatever, they can choose how to use that, build a new road, put it towards their education system. It's none of our business. They do what they want with it. They know what their society needs. Somewhere in that chain, someone has decided that those people should not have that control. And that's why these big organizations are saying, no, we're going to keep that money in a pot here. And you guys can't have it. We'll choose how you're going to spend that. Now, to me, that makes no sense whatsoever, does it?
Well, it is a repeat of the systems. So it's taking half of the model. So saying, yes, great, let's have a regenerative farm program, but then losing the other half of the program that is convenient to some degree. Because obviously, in the old model, control hierarchy, total autonomy over a situation is the preferred route. And what we do within the Radice Cotton system, working with GVK Society, is there is more equalization of, it's a shared value chain. And we don't own the land. And we're not leasing the land. We're working in partnership with the tribal farmers to make sure that they and their lives are enriched by it, that they totally own what has been theirs for however many centuries, and that that is not diluted by, because we do have to be careful of the mistakes of the past and the colonialism and what has happened. And therefore, we have to look at ourselves within that and just be sure that we don't repeat the same mistakes whilst thinking that we are doing something good.
But when you're talking with customers, especially business customers, big hotels that you mentioned and other organizations, how do they react to this idea of that could be perceived as lack of control with regards to the business model and more regenerative
Well,
nature
that's,
of the offering.
yeah, I mean, it's not their problem, is it? That risk is ours to a degree. They will get their products, and that risk is ours. Because the other thing within the model is obviously we're working so much further ahead, because it isn't a case of push the button and it's there. We have to plan ahead. We have to grow it. We have to spin it. We can gin it. Yeah, we have to put it into fabrics. Then we have to make the garments. So it's a very long process, and I think that's the other thing for brands to get their head around. You know, that commitment and that forecasting is so much earlier, and that's another big reason why I've embraced some more of the hospitality route. Because as much as we also work with fashion brands, and we have a big sweet spot in the sleepwear sector, also. Yeah, that's just key.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right about the timing. I mean, when I haven't I think another thing, it'd be really interesting if you could say how Papillon Bleu has actually worked with Radisson in the sense of booking land. See what I mean? Can you explain that?
Yes, I mean, we merely need to say in advance for, you know, by April, really, for the following October. What we're committing to for that year, and there is a minimum entry for any brands out there that would, you know, love to come and do the same thing, which we would welcome everyone with open arms, because really the big program here is about regenerating land and also regenerating lives. And if you know anything about the system in India and what's gone on in recent years with, you know, cotton farmers, it's a modern day travesty. And therefore, yeah, it is about land regeneration, but really people too. So in terms of that works, as I said, so we plant in October in monsoon season, then by December we'll have like three rounds of harvesting, and we'll end up with our yield for that year. And then it's the process of ginning and spinning. And then we develop each year new fabrics. So the waffle is a new one for this year. And for sneak preview, we're now working for next year on a lovely terry toweling. And other thing we've been doing, which is really cool, is at the end of when we've woven all the fabrics, so our brush cottons, our poplins, our jerseys, our waffles, when we've woven all of that for the season, we then have waste fiber, and then we re-spin that into waste fabric. So we've got a double knit jersey and a single jersey, like t-shirt fabric, and they're just really great fabrics. But also that feeling that we waste nothing at all is, yeah, it just great. And from marketing, you know, for brands as well, it's what are these key things that people are going to buy into? Because we have to sell the products that we create. So it's yeah.
So Papillon Bleu has made this commitment to Radisson that you're going to use this certain amount of land and take the yield from that land.
Yes.
But organizations, if they're making big orders, big commitments, can do that themselves, can't they? So they can
They
go.
can, exactly. And we'd encourage them to do so, because, you know, the bigger brands multiplied, you know, the more and more bigger brands we have, the more and more land and people we can actually affect. So, yes, as Papillon Bleu, we can create the products, we can do it for you. But even if someone wanted to begin there and then start their own program, because that in as a longer term could work, you know, we're here to make it happen. And brands can choose, I guess, ha how they join. But yeah, I believe as we go along in the next couple of years, not only now is everyone waking up to sustainability, but the more and more information people have, the more, as I say, traceable programs, everyone, big brands, smaller brands, everyone's going to, in my mind, going to start moving this way.
I think in terms of transparency, in terms of end customers and end customers want to know the stories behind what they're buying. We know that for sure. But there's also going to be lots more legislation which will be pressuring, to say the least, forcing businesses to be able to to have to be able to give out the information about where things are coming from. It can't stay in the opaque way that it has been.
No, yeah, exactly. And already happening. And it was always going to take probably a stick over a carrot to make everybody brands, start to actually say, well, we ha now have to change.
Absolutely.
So I think it's a combination of the mood of the market and the laws, which is making brands, because in the last 12 months, the shift has been quite phenomenal, I think. What
It
I've
is
That's what I'm
interesting.
witnessing.
I mean, I'm not as much of a pioneer as you in the sense that the first, I can't remember when I started up the first brand that I started, but Where Does It Come From was started working on that in 2012. And I'm really aware that there was just hardly any coverage of anything around ethical and sustainable really in the mainstream press or on TV or anything like that. Whereas now it's just all the time, isn't it? You can't escape from it unless you're Primark. And even then,
No.
can't escape from it.
No. I remember I used to go around with my bag of, with my suitcase full of sustainable fabrics. Like I said, because I was on a quest for a very long time and still am with regard to fabrics, because I love fabrics and, sustainable fabrics, obviously. And I'd get this this suitcase filled with, in my mind, the best that was out there. And before you'd even unzip the case, people, and you'd said sustainable fabric, people get, oh no, we're not interested in that. But okay, don't even open the case then. And as you say, that was the general reaction back then, that it was somehow niche, go hug a tree, thanks very much, but we do not want that. Apologies.
They don't need it. They didn't need it, did they? That was the thing. Whereas now there's customers out there who are demanding it's got to have a story. But I still think there's a lack of awareness yet. And not that people listening to this will know if they've listened to this podcast at all, but fabric that clothing and fashion starts with the fabric, which is great, but they don't think, where did that fabric come from? How did that fiber come about? There's still a lack
Yeah.
of awareness up until the stage when there's a piece of fabric in front of them. And that's something that is changing, I think, but it's slow.
Yeah. We were out there last November, and I took a beautiful documentary filmmaker with me to speak with the tribal farmers. Obviously, it was translated. I'm afraid I don't speak the local dialect, but it was just really lovely to get that real feedback. And sorry, your point, you were just the question you were asking just there, because it
Well,
was
I mean,
relevant to filming.
I was just thinking about the stories, really. So it's very relevant. There's
Yeah.
people wanting to know the stories behind things, but from
Yes.
before the fabric existed.
Yeah. And the point that I made was, she was actually at the end of the week so blown away. She was like, I cannot believe what goes into making a t-shirt. Like, I'm not an unintelligent person, but that has blown my mind, like how many hands it takes and how much of a process to get there. Yeah.
I remember years ago, going back to about 2018, I was running an event at the what's it called, the Brands Museum in London, and we had a panelist there, Sabina, and she was basically saying that somebody had said to her that they thought t-shirts were made by robots. They did not realize that people were involved in the creation of garments, and that's why they were so cheap, because there were no people involved, and it couldn't be further from the truth.
No, but actually, when you think about some of those people within those systems, it's not very humane. They might as well not be people.
That's fairly true, but we do need we AI
No,
is over, robotics is not
I'm
quite.
saying in terms of how we respect, the lack of
Absolutely.
respect within those supply chains. And that's, back to that movie, The True Cost,
Love.
somewhere, something is paying somewhere.
Exactly. And we might, again, it's back to our economic model again. We're just thinking in terms of the money, but not in t speaking in terms of the value that these people are putting in, and also the impacts, which are not always monetary, in terms of environmental damage. And as you say, impacts on the people, their communities, people
Yeah.
migrating, away from their families, hideous things that we wouldn't want to see. But because it's a long way away, we can.
We just have a complete disconnect. We've disconnected from the supply chains, disconnected from nature. Two-thirds of, the market is saturated with polyester, petrochemical synthetic fibers, and we're not even awake to the fact. So it is an education piece, and I'm certainly not sitting here with any judgment. But as you say, are we even aware of the compositions of what we're wearing, where it was made? Are we even asking those questions as consumers.
More and more, but not enough, I would say. Thank
Yeah.
you. You just reminded me as well. So I've made this comment about the fabric being turned into, but once the fabric exists, turning it into beautiful products. How do you do yours, and where do yours? How do you create your products?
Well, we have a variety of methods. Obviously, I've been in the manufacturing supply chain for since 2006. So we have the opportunity to produce in India with a factory that I've worked with for many, many years, originally starting with Papillon Bleu when it was a brand. And that is when we're specifically working with the embroideries, really gorgeous hand embroideries, which elevate product. And then we also have a setup and partnership in Sri Lanka by which we produce products. And really, that is a slightly higher volume model, but obviously, you're getting the advantage of pricing. So, all within an ethical, approved. Smetter approved factory. So all of the ethics are covered, but you just are getting that sort of price advantage. And sometimes we have to work with balancing up that a client wants a price. And then we also produce in Romania with a wonderful factory called Catty Fashion, who work on the more mid to high-end fashion side. And I also share a factory here. Well, it's not a share a factory. I share a building, and below me, as we speak, I can hear the machines going. We have a little micro factory here, which belonged to Circular Inc. And we are currently about to start working on the end of life for the robes. So we'll basically work in from that pattern. Inevitably, when that robe comes back, covered in curry sleeves or whatever somebody in the hotel has done with it, then we will recreate those into hotel slippers. So
Wonderful.
that's part of the model.
And that's great as well because you haven't got the carbon footprint of
So I'm
shipping.
skipping around there, but yeah, manufacturing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it sounds amazing.
Realistic.
Yeah,
But
amazing.
for end of life, we know that those hotels will chew, not chew the robes up, but they'll get through them and inevitably they'll get dirty and we do not want them to throw them away. So that's the next piece for us to work on that, complete circular end of life solution.
Wonderful, because I mean
Which will
that
go along with the digital passports that we're now creating. So that was something else to mention because we have all of this wonderful provenance and a really unique story. And there isn't much out there at the moment, because the regenerative agriculture and textiles is still quite small in terms of the overall market. So yeah, the digital passport to really celebrate everyone involved, the social impact, farmers, and everyone have a real sense. So it'll be a QR code on the garment. And then you'll always have access to that full story.
And that's interesting, isn't it? Because that's obviously something that I've always done with Where Does It Come From, is have that QR code stroke alphanumeric code so people can find with the stories. But what I wanted to extend, and I'm sure it's the same to you, so with Sandra Stories Jeans, what we're actually doing, hence the stories in the name, the digital passport can be added to afterwards as well. So the idea is that because the jeans, and I'm sure the same with robes, because their design can be used by lots more people than just one. It's not a question of one person buying an item and keeping it. You might pass it on, you might sell it on to somebody else, or in your case with the robes, turn them into something else. That
Exactly.
it's great to catch that in the digital passport, and it's the customer then, it's a positive thing that you've got those stories, how it was created or how it was looked after, who had it, who what special occasion someone might have worn something to, and then it was turned into something else. And that's keeping that longevity going, but keeping a record of that longevity as a
Yeah.
positive thing. So I think it's
Yeah, I mean, I
quite
think it works on a couple of levels. I think one, information is king and inspiration is queen, shall we say. So, inspiring people into these amazing, kind of wonderfully joyous, sustainable, business models is a great thing. But I also believe that with the greenwashing that's going on, it's a way on a garment that you can say we're for real and this is the reality behind it. Because we all know what's happening with some of the brands. They'll use a tiny little thing and spin it and spin it. And yeah, I really think it's important to get granular about impact metrics. Where does it come from exactly? How is it made? And to have all of that really transparent for the buyer.
Absolutely, definitely. And yeah, like we've touched on fossil fuels in fibers as well. We've touched on all the different elements in terms of longevity and things like that. We've covered cotton. I know that you and I could talk about cotton for hours and hours and hours, but you're also doing a very exciting project within the UK because one thing that really does help with areas like carbon footprint is being able to not having to ship huge amounts of fiber or cloth across the world. And with cotton, we have to do that
Yes.
because it doesn't grow locally. Tell us what you're doing with UK fiber because it's so exciting.
We started a pilot in Leicestershire in the UK growing hemp. And it's a fascinating, the whole story around hemp is so interesting in the sense that it's a totally forgotten fiber. Everybody has a misinformation about hemp, industrial hemp, and they think that somehow it's cannabis. And the straight, which it isn't, and we'll come back to that because it's all about the amount of THC, which is in, so it's below 0.03, which means you, it is literally not a drug. But the strange thing is that we, as Papillon Bleu, have a license to grow hemp in the UK. And to get that, I have to have a drug license to grow it. And equally, that license is provided by the Home Office. So it's not by DEFRA, who are the agricultural people in this country, which would make the most sense. And it is incredibly hard to get a license. We were turned down quite a lot of times. So it does feel as if the legislation is prohibitive and slightly draconian. It's certainly not encouraging farmers to do it, which is crazy because, you know, plants to grow that can sequester carbon. Carbon, we're all talking about, you know, reaching net zero. Hemp is one of the most positive solutions that we could find, and also the myriad of benefits of products that you can create for it. So obviously we're in pioneering regenerative agriculture and textiles. Our focus is on creating a textile with it. And interestingly, no, well, in the UK, the only things being produced with hemp are non-wovens. So it's been used for animal bedding or feeding mattresses. When I say feeding mattresses, I mean filling the insides of them in Harrison and Spink's version of what they're doing and the model of growing hemp here in the UK. But yeah, so we have basically, we won't launch this until April of this year. So I don't talk that much about it because I always think I'd rather do something than talk about it. But we have been working now in partnership with Ilnois down in Yorkshire, Dr. John Parkinson, who is the most fantastic, entertaining, knowledgeable speaker when it comes to shoddy, which is all about waste fabrics. So they produce post-consumer yarns from post-consumer wool and cashmere, and we have blended that with hemp to elevate and create this interiors. Well, we will be creating this interiors fabric. But the idea for me was always to give hemp a bit of a new look because it has a really bad reputation. Everyone thinks it's like coarse and hempy. And I wanted to blend it with something that would give it this elevated status. And the interesting thing is it's naturally fire retardant when you blend it with wool. So all of these things about fire retardancy, and again, when we talk about textile processing and what we add, if you go into interior land and start looking about how many natural fibers there are in the offering, it's actually quite shocking how little there is.
And what
And
sprays on
obviously,
the
hemp's
ones that are.
incredibly durable as the tensile strength. And equally, we can, from the, because we have the fiber, we also have the shiv when we separate it, which we have to pass it through a decorticator. And we happen to have one 15 minutes down the road from the farm in Leicestershire, which I think there's only three in the whole country. So we're just lucky. And when we separate those fibers, the shiv fiber can be used for building construction, plasterboard. Yeah. So there are a myriad. I mean, I could go on about all the other products that you can create with hemp, but it's insane that it was criminalized. I think it's only 2018 in America that they've lifted it, as in they've said, no, the ban's gone. It's still, we still have, it's still illegal here,
It's
which
mad.
is just
It is crazy.
policy gone nuts.
And you know, locally to me, there's, and you know them well, I know, Claire and Kitty, who are doing contemporary
Yes.
hempery just up the road in Suffolk, and they've been growing it, but they're very much going through the craft processes for turning that into fibers and fabric. I went up to the hemp harvest in the summer, actually, and we were picking hemp, and they're pulling all the leaves off and doing everything by hand, and then they're going to put it in a pit and have it turn into wet it down and things like that. So highly interesting and fascinating. So it's quite interesting to compare. You're both growing it, and then you're turning it into a workable interiors fabric, all being well, and they're looking through all of the processes. But again, they've been on the podcast, so if anyone listening wants to go back and listen to what Claire and Kitty have been doing up in Suffolk with contemporary hempery, please do. But again, this whole problem of getting the license came out, and how sort of, what would you say, looking historical, I suppose, is this fear that people think you're going to pull your car over, go into the field and light up based on what's growing in the field. And as Claire was saying, she had to have aerial shots taken to show there were no roads passing the field where the hemp was growing, and ridiculous things like that, because there's this misconception that people will want to smoke it or do something else with it, which is safe.
And but the interesting thing, without going down a rabbit hole, is how these things begin, because they're quite purposeful. And this whole misinformation started with the DuPont family in America. So they wanted to bring out rayon, which was their synthetic fiber. You know, after the war had ended, they needed to put their ammunition scientists to some other purpose, and obviously created these rayon fabrics. And hemp, really, for them, was seen as the largest competitor, because obviously it grows in 100 days. So, yeah, the whole legislation that was passed, a bill in America decriminalizing hemp on the back of hemp cannabis, was all a propaganda for the benefit of DuPont. And that's what's interesting when we sit here as consumers. And I think a lot has come out in food, and that we understand more and more, like, what's actually in our food, and understanding that the benefit and the nutrition is not there for us. It's profit and bottom line. And so when we apply the same thing to fashion, and we start to understand, yeah, what we can change there too.
We're back to economic models again, aren't we? It's all about who can make that buck. And I think what's always interesting as well with economic models is they talk about the customer is always right, but actually it's the customer losing out as well as the rest of the value chain. There's only a certain number of people who are gaining from the situation, and they tend to be somewhere in the middle, not at either end, I would say, is the problem we've got there. That's such an exciting
Yeah, but I
thing.
just want to say about, sorry,
You carry on.
I was just going to say about the hempery contemporary as well, because I think one of the things that is really beneficial in the new way of working, shall we say, is one that is much more collaborative in terms of information sharing. So, for example, Kitty, Claire, and I have consistently shared information because we're both experiencing problems in different ways. And so we will, well, I found this solution, I found this machine, I know this person who can do that. Or, and so it's that spirit of, sharing information to reach a common goal rather than the opposite.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, collaborative working. I found that all my time working in the sort of ethical, sustainable area, everyone's been about sharing and collaboration and wanting to help each other to move it on. And it is working. I mean, the figures I was looking at yesterday from the Ethical Markets report for last year, I think the ethical market in the UK has grown to something like 141 billion or something like that. So every year, I think it stayed static the last couple of years because of the economic crisis. But it was something like 19 billion at the turn of the millennium, and now it's 141 billion, which might not sound massive, but it's growing. It's growing. People are interested. People are working it. And we don't compete. We work together. We help each other as much as we can. It sounds a bit airy fairy, hippy dippy, but actually, that is how it is. We like
Completely,
it. We like it this
completely.
way.
Or just like me working with in-law, I mean, I haven't been upcycling post-consumer, jumpers for the last however many decades. So why
Why
would
would
we
you?
possibly, everybody works to their strengths and brings,
The value.
a bigger advantage by bringing more effectively collectively.
Exactly. Oh, good. Effectively, collectively, another good one. I don't want to talk too much longer because I know people are probably wanting to move on to their next thing in their day. But I just wanted to ask you what you we're positive. We know that things are changing and people wanting to get involved with this and support regenerative work, ethical work, fair trade, all of those areas that the values-based work that we're doing. And everyone on this podcast who has ever been on this podcast is also working in this area. What do you perceive, Vanessa, as the barriers to success? What things could happen, and how can people listening help move us through these areas into greener pastures?
I'm going to use the word choices because I think that is whether we are a consumer, whether we're a fashion designer, whether we're a buyer for a big brand, it comes down to choice. And it sounds boring, but we almost have to be a little bit more restrictive with ourselves. It is a bit like eating junk food at every single meal that you ever have. And although I understand that wearing fast fashion, perhaps isn't going to affect you internally the way that eating junk food is, it still is about being aware of that conscious decision that you're making and the further impact that it has. So a decoupling from the polyester fibers and choosing not to invest in those, making your clothes last longer and buying clothes that come from an ethical supply chain. Buying secondhand clothes, sharing, swapping. It's choice and a pausing at that moment of choice and making the choice to make a better choice. If I can
Absolutely.
bring it back to the simplicity, because we can hang everything else off it, but it really is about a choice. What choice do you want to make today and the impacts that will have if you stop to think about it?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that extends as well into your role within a business. So whatever business you are in your, so you might be listening to this as a individual person, but you can bring that with you into the workplace and ask questions and say, hey, where are our textiles being sourced from? Because most companies buy t-shirts and uniforms and all of those kind of things. You can actually go and influence that, put that hat on and go and fight for a future that is a bit more regenerative in your own sphere of influence. And we all have it. And that's very empowering, I think, for individuals. Don't just see yourself as a cog in the machine. Go in there and push things
Yeah.
inside the machine. I would encourage people, speak out.
Speak out and celebrate is what I would say. I really want sustainability to be a joyous thing that everyone can get involved with and enjoy, just like we enjoy, fashion and expression.
Yeah.
So I know there's a lot of doom and gloom and facts and figures. It's like, but I really think we can reframe it and just create some really cool, innovative, wonderful products that are traceable and look after the people who make them and regenerate the land by which they're grown.
Absolutely. By the way, I must take exception to your comment that wearing fast fashion isn't going to affect you on the inside like junk food.
Oh, I do agree with that. As I said it, I do actually know. I said to the extent,
Yeah.
which means that all of these toxic chemicals are, your skin is the largest organ of your body. You are absorbing these chemicals and they are, affecting you. And we look at the cancerous situation and the rise of that. And we're surrounded by toxicity and it's hidden in our textiles and our surroundings. So, yes,
Microplastics,
I
lots of
completely concur.
micro. I saw a lovely little cartoon on Facebook where it was it said, we can end on this note, we're all a little bit Barbie these days because of microplastics.
That's great.
I really like that. No,
I
sorry, I've
love it.
spoiled that one. We've got a little bit of Barbie in us, they said. We've all got a little bit of Barbie in us because of microplastics. Anyway, thank you, Vanessa. So would you like to tell people how they can find you, get in touch? That video you were talking about that you made in India, I'm sure people would like to watch it. I know I would. Where can we do that?
Oh, well, you can go onto the website at www.papillonbleu.com, and on the homepage, there is one of our little videos. And the second thing is, if anyone is interested from, on a business perspective, obviously contact me at vanessa@papillonbleu.com or whoever you are, wherever you are. If this has touched you and you want to reach out, I'm here and I'd love to hear from you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Vanessa, for spending the time with us today on the Where Does It Come From podcast.
Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you for listening to the Where Does It Come From podcast. Please rate us on your platform and follow us so that we can share this podcast with more people. And if you'd like to find out more about the work of Where Does It Come From, please visit our website on wheredoesitcomefrom.co.uk for kind clothes that tell tales.